I'm in the Australian Pavilion now talking to Judy Watson. And Judy, we're standing downstairs in the pavilion and it's in twilight really, but the paintings are spotlit, so there's a sense of a kind of an evening light.
I made the lighting like this, yes. I wanted to have a subterranean feeling within this space. This space you have to walk down into from the other space within the Australian Pavilion. I also wanted to make a connection with the canal which is outside the pavilion. When I make the work, I mean, I'm sort of often in sunlight in my studio in Sydney, but it's at night that I resolve the work, and so this is the sort of light that I wanted to bring into it.
If we can walk closer to the paintings, there are things about it, in terms of the surface and the marks, that remind me of a certain tradition in Australian art, particularly Australian Aboriginal art. Would you see that as a relevant comment or reading?
Well, because I'm Aboriginal, I guess it's a relevant comment. My mother's side of the family is Aboriginal, my father's side is Scottish-English. And this particular work, the one on the left that you're looking at, is Deadly Bloom, then there's Memory Veil, and then there's a work called Red Tides. The titles of the work, Red Tides and Deadly Bloom, came from newspaper articles which were documenting the prevalence of algae blooms in Sydney Harbour towards the end of last year and earlier this year when I was making the work. I wanted to parallel the waterways, the canals of Venice itself. And when I saw the words in the newspaper, Red Tides, it also reminded me of Australia's own history of massacres. In fact, the name of a place in the Gulf of Carpentaria, which is our country, called Massacre Inlet. So I'm making parallels to Australia's own history. And also, I mean, this was the titling for the Red Tides. It used to be awash around places where there were whaling stations. It's a very poetic sort of title too.
So it seems that the primary preoccupation of yours is to deal with issues of currency, that is, to do with the environment, to do with politics, to do with autobiography, reference and personal history?
Yeah, it's like an archaeology, but there's also place, geography, site, history, all of these come into it.
I mean, formally, the pieces, such as the one we're looking at, seems to me to have a very sort of liquidy quality. It's layers of bled colour overlaid, and then there's patterning going over it.
Mm-hmm.
Is that because of the reference to the sea and to water?
It is, and also that spiralling sort of pattern of the pastel, which is like a mesh or a veil, which overlays the fluid layers of pigment which have been poured and washed onto the surface of the canvas. I sometimes see as almost being like dust storms or myriads of haze which obscure and reveal at the same time. I also see them as being a symbol for change.
We see another one now again which continues this series. Were these works actually made for this pavilion?
They were made just towards the end of last year and earlier this year, specifically for the Venice Biennale. I'd been to this pavilion once before in 1995. This work over here, Canyon, was specifically made for this space here. So it echoes the architecture of the roof. When you walk around to the side of it, you can see a light, a golden light, emanating from the back. And in fact, one of the Norwegian artists came in and commented that he thought the works created their own sacred light. And I was very pleased, you know, to sort of hear that comment.
How do you see yourself in relation to contemporary art in Australia, because you've talked a lot about issues of ethnicity and multiculturalism.
There's a lot of issues which are currently under debate within Australia itself, and so I think given the current political climate, it's very timely that our work should be shown. Also, there's, you know, 50% of Aboriginal artists working within Australia are women, and Aboriginal women's work is very significant and well respected both internationally and nationally, and it deserves to be here.
Yvonne Cumitry.
Yvonne, we're in the pavilion, Australian Pavilion, next to two pieces of work by you. Could you describe them?
These two pieces here are two eel traps that has been used for centuries. And in 82, they were nearly extinct, so I'm travelling, reviving and teaching and, yeah.
The structure's rather reminiscent of elongated hats or musical horns. They're woven from a sort of a raffia material.
Yes, they're woven from rushes, a sedge grass that I use here, and it's the traditional grass that I use here.
Can you talk about your use of this traditional trap? Because they're actually used, aren't they? Or they have been for a long time.
Well, these pieces here, they haven't been used for, say, 50, 60 years, maybe more. There's just no one around that's doing them anymore, like the elders passed on. And so that leaves me. I was taught in 82 by the last person that was weaving. She taught me to do baskets and mats, and that's just the basic stitching. So I'm just carrying on the tradition. I've been into museums, and because there was no one I can go to and ask, so I had to go back to the museums and do a bit of research in there.
Right. So as a reference, it's clearly to do with Aboriginal tradition and so on. Is this a kind of an agenda in your work?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is an agenda, yes. As I said, this was nearly extinct, and I am trying to teach. Well, I am passing it on to my son, which he is really excellent. He's up with me. He can do just about anything, but he's not known yet.
What part of Australia do you work in?
I live in South Australia, in the Riverland. That's about 3 hours from Adelaide.
The particular pieces you've got here are eel traps. Are there any other examples of objects that you make?
Yes, I make the burial mats, the egg scoops. When they used to gather the eggs, they never used to reach into the nest and just touch all the eggs. They made it a long scoop to reach in so they wouldn't disturb the birds as they go. Burial mats, big mats to camp on or to protect, for protection, works as an umbrella. There's not many pieces. That is about the only traditional pieces here. But I can reproduce all those pieces.
Do you see yourself as part of a group of Aboriginal artists in Australia involved with dealing with these issues?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. Because it is... Like, I'm the only one in Australia that's producing these pieces now. So, yeah, that's sort of... I am involved with everything.
So to develop a piece of work, you will go back into your history and into Aboriginal tradition to find a source?
Yes, that's the only way. To do a traditional piece, yes, I have to go back and do research in museums. I travelled to Perth in about 3 years ago, and first time I've ever seen a burial basket. And so that was way over there. So we have got things scattered all over the in different states too, yes, not only in South Australia. So I've got to do a lot of research here.
What about sort of more Western traditions of contemporary art? Because there's a substantial number of white artists, if I can call them that, working in Australia. And we know the strength of European contemporary art. I mean, how does that refer or cross-reference your work? I mean, are you influenced by anything particular happening in Europe?
No, not really. I'm just...
You work more or less exclusively with your own...
With my own, yes, with my own...
agenda.
Yes, I do, yes.
How many of these pieces would you make in a year? Because they must take a lot of time. You weave them, do you?
I weave them, and it's... I don't make many pieces. It all depends if there's an exhibition and someone wants my work. I will make those pieces freshly... sort of to stand the time if I'm going to sell them to a gallery, so it'll take me a long time to collect my material and to select the best rushes so they can stand the test of time.
Was this particular piece made for this pavilion, for this exhibition?
It was made for this exhibition, yes.
And generally, how do you feel about being here now that you've installed the work in the pavilion? I mean, do you think the Venice Biennale is a good context for you to show in?
Oh, yes. Well, I was on his saying last night, now I'm linked with Venice, so there's going to be a piece to link Venice with Australia. So in the future, there's going to be a piece woven, yes.
But all your work seems to arise out of your own experience and your
yes,
own
yes, that's
place.
Right, yes, yes.
Your own sight.
In my own sight, yes, yeah.
Now I'm with Georges Bachy in the Church of San Basso, which is just on the edge of St. Mark's Square. You have a piece here that, if I can just describe it, there are eight containers with soil in, and you are growing what appear to be vegetables in this darkened church with spotlights above each of the containers. Can you talk about the piece?
I start with the idea that this place is not really a place for exhibition, not really the church. And I decided to put the church into the dark. The next step is how to find this reason to put the light in again. So I decided to put the especially light for the vegetables. So my idea is to have cabbage garden in the church to mix real life with the art so that we don't know really if this is art or not.
Walking into churches in Venice, one experiences a sense of history, but also of the past, of tradition, often death. And to come into a church and see a kind of a living process makes quite an impact. It's in opposition to the weight of the Venetian church.
I like this idea, that you have this possibility to be in the San Marco place, and we know that Venice is in the summer very hot, and a lot of tourists are here, and they are tired. So they have this possibility to use this church like some kind of strange flat. Besides the garden, I have some kind of chairs and beds. At the same time, I have water. It is not so important that all people will know that this is the piece from the Venice Biennale. It is important to have this possibility that little child came into the church and he or she has this possibility to see something very strange.
You've chosen to grow functional plants, such as food-providing plants,
yes,
like cabbages and so on, rather than flowers.
In the Baroque gardens, they used cabbages only for this beauty. If I will use flowers, it will be more connected with the art. When I have this problem that maybe this is too arty, I like to find another way.
Another unforgettable element of your project here is this water bottle that, yes, that you are giving out.
If you have alive things like cabbages here, these cabbages need water, and we need water too. You have this possibility to take water here and to take water all around. My idea is that life is very fluid. Everything is changing, so this piece is changing too. So the water is here. We can see less and less water, but you can see these cabbages will be bigger and bigger. And this man who will be here through the whole summer, he slowly becomes part of this exhibition too, because he really waters this cabbage, he really uses these chairs. And I like this mixture, real life, art, and all these things. So I think a lot of projects in this Venice Biennale, they try to do something on this way too.
So I'm Zdenka Badovinac. I'm a commissioner of Slovene Pavilion, and I'm director of a museum of modern art called Moderna Galleria Ljubljana.
Tell me about the installation here in this church, which is just on the edge of St. Mark's Square.
It's made by Slovene sculptor Jože Bachy, and the title of the installation is "There are many answers to the questions why to grow vegetables." If you change the word vegetable with the word art, the idea is much clearer. Jože Bachy wanted to make a pleasant situation here, something for the visitors, and these visitors were not abstract visitors, but were very concrete, tired visitors in Venice. As he took care about the space, which is concrete, so he treated also in the same way the visitors, which are really people. So everybody is allowed, of course, to come here, to lay, maybe to sleep here, to drink water, or to write a postcard or whatever. So when you stop into the church, first there are many different elements, vegetables, which is growing, which is changing every day. And this vegetable is some kind of a metaphor. It is connected very much also with time and space. So Jože Barshi in the catalog included different spaces, his home, his garden, his surrounding when he works. So very different spaces, which are in fact part of his work. So the work, it isn't just here in this concrete space, in this spot, but also at his home, and also the work spread outside the walls of this church with the bottles of mineral water we prepared for this exhibition. So visitors are protagonists of the work. So the work is not just made with each visitor, but it is also spread by them outside the church.
I'm now sitting with Richard Smith, and I'm interested to know two things. One is, what do you think of the current Biennale, and are there any high points in it for you?
I'm enjoying being here, and so I think the pavilions all look like, in a way, like shop windows for their countries or whatever, but they also in a way look like shop windows, and you find that you're standing on the edge of them looking in at like a passing show. I mean, I haven't seen any paintings that I'm particularly involved in, but I thought the selection of works in the Italian pavilion that Chimano Chilanta's selected was an interesting kind of overall survey, you know, little too much accent on America, but then you don't know.
You actually were here at the Biennale. You represented Britain, didn't you, a while ago?
I've been at the Biennale twice. I was here with a group of five or six artists in 66. There was Harold Cohen and Bernard Cohen, Robin Denny and Tony Caro. And then I had the pavilion to myself in 70. I was showing some very large paintings, you know, painting 30-foot paintings, which fitted beautifully into the pavilion. The pavilion is such a great building. I'm back this time as a tourist, really. It's been 13 or 14 years since I've been to a Biennale, and I just thought it would be interesting to see the international art scene en route. I live in New York, and so you're in a perpetual art event.
It must be strange for you to go into the pavilion again after all this time. I don't know what you think of Rachel Whitread's installation there.
No, I think it's a splendid installation. It really looks very nice within the space. And the great thing about the pavilion is that it doesn't change. You know, I mean, it's such a solid, good building, and the layout remains static. And so the building is familiar. I saw a video of the 66 Biennale a couple of months ago, and you can't really believe that much time has passed.
The event itself must be very different, or was it just as much a circus then as it is now?
Absolutely. It's the same. I get the same vibrations, and a lot of the same people looking rather older.
Come on. Barry Barker, this is the 30th anniversary of the Listen Gallery. Yeah. Here we are in Venice. You've just come from Basel. Come on.
That's right, yeah. And I've worked for 2 years at the Listen Gallery, but I still remember the last 28 as well.
It's a historic evening, isn't it, really?
I think it is. It's great. Yeah, it's very good. I mean, there's lots of people here. It's amazing over those years. Yeah, it really is. I mean, it's amazing what the artists have achieved, too, because I think that's what matters. I mean, that's what's important about Listen Gallery. It has good artists.
I'll talk to Nicholas in a minute, but he has defined a whole kind of era, hasn't he, in relation to the artists
he's supported. Yes, he has, very much so, yeah. I mean, he's always managed to have a good eye and get involved with artists very early on, and that only means one thing, that he's got a good eye, and that's really what's made the gallery, really. I think it is, absolutely true.
Right. So what about Basel? You've just come from there.
Basel's fine, it's great. The opening was very good, lots of people. Yesterday was very quiet because everybody's in Venice. So it's this kind of
thing. Which is where we are now.
Which is where we are now, yes, of course. So I go back tomorrow evening, and I'm back working in Basel at the weekend, which we expect a lot of people come to over the weekend before they then go to Kassel. And then on to Munster. So this particular month has been extremely... You'll find a lot of tired people at the end of June, I think.
Yeah. Are you going to Kassel and Munster?
Yes, I am. Yes, I'm going to do that. Because Kassel, we've got artists in there, like Dan Graham, Art and Language. Munster, we've got Christine Ball and Douglas Gordon. Dan Graham again, and quite a few other artists. So, yeah.
What about Basel? Which artists are you showing there?
Artists, we're featuring a very very good Anish Kapoor, a very new one, stainless steel, cast stainless steel. We have Christine Borland, we have the Jane Louise Wilson. We've got a very good piece by Rodney Graham as well, echoing his, what I understand, although I haven't seen it yet, but wonderful piece in the Canadian Pavilion. We have a mixture of interesting younger artists as well as some really kind of key works as well by older artists.
Nicholas, I think I have to congratulate you. This is the 30th anniversary of Listen yes. Gallery in Venice.
And we're talking to Count Panza.
Oh, yes, because we met many years ago, just 30 years ago. And it was a young gallery in London in this time, but he had the best artist. In this way, we had a good relationship because it was possible to see, to buy the best artist which was working in England in this time. And was the young generation, Richard Long, Hamish Fulton, all this artist was very good, and Alan Charton, many others, was with the Listen Gallery, Peter Joseph, and was a pleasure to have this relationship, to find a gallery which was able to collect, to offer the best artist of a new generation when this artist was not yet recognized, was still left alone because was new, there was no a lack of interest, but Nicholas was able to do this job, which was very important for our collection, because this way it was possible to have the best artist of this new time.
Right. Nicholas, how do you reflect on the 30 years? I mean, obviously you've done a lot of important things. I mean, you've defined a whole
I was just telling Panza in the early days, he had a wonderful way of paying. He would buy a lot, very, very carefully. He would spend days selecting it. But then he would negotiate a payment over 1 or 2 years. And so we knew that the Panza payment was coming through every 3 months. And so that gave the gallery a lot of faith to do adventurous things, which maybe on the face of it initially you could look at and say, this is not economic at the moment, but you believe in it and it can be economic in the future. And Giuseppe also came back some years later and became interested in Grenville Davy, yes. And Jan Verkroes.
Yeah.
Who else is there? One or two others, huh?
Yes, mainly, mostly these two artists.
Yes. The first exhibition was no idea to have a gallery. It was to make a show with my artist friends, and then Professor Coldstream at the Slade wasn't too keen on this because I was taking up too much time. So he suggested that maybe I should leave the Slade. Well, it was one of those fortuitous things that happens, and at the time, you don't really have a lot of choice. Or I didn't think I did. And friends said, this show went well, why don't we do another one? And what kept me going was that every time I did a show, I learnt so much and met very interesting people. And my education was incredibly faster than it was hanging around the sort of rather provincial London art world. And within the first year, I started to travel. And when I started to travel, it became very clear that London in 1967 was a very, very local, provincial place. And, of course, I was already aware that New York had been a centre for a very long time. And my first visit to New York was quite incredible. And I met Sol LeWitt. I saw the work of Bob Ryman. I met Dan Graham on the second trip. I met Carl Andre. And many other artists of this generation. There was an incredible family of artists in New York at this time, weren't there? And it was a very exciting time. And it was the beginning of something that I would call internationalism. Although it was very much New York-led, the philosophy of the artists was very much that for the first time, artists could emerge and be seen worldwide. And a circuit of galleries developed at that time, starting in 66, 67, 68, notably Conrad Fischer, Ginenzo Speroni, myself in London, Dwan Gallery in New York, later to become John Weber, Yvon Lambert in Paris, Galerie MTL a little later in Brussels, and I probably missed one or two, but the spirit of it for some years was one of friendly competition, and it was incredible excitement that something was absolutely changing in the visual culture. And one of the most locomotive forces for that was conceptual art itself, because it was so radical. And in a way, it was trying to defeat the old systems and defeat the old-fashioned kind of art merchandising. So we all, I think, had a very new spirit, and I think you were... Giuseppe Panza was really incredibly instrumental in supporting this. Well, for me, firstly, this sort of great revelation about the London art world and how provincial it was at the time, I realised that there was no future whatsoever just to focus on the British situation, and the very good emerging British artists had to be integrated with something more international. And I guess that we were the first gallery to recognise that. I think for me, what's always interesting and is still interesting today is the absolute excitement of seeing something new that you think is... that you really feel changes your perception of something. Every artist I've been right about has changed one's sense of the subject they're dealing with in one's relation to the real world. And I think that's the great gift artists have to culture. And it's the very essence of what makes a human being human. And the last 5 years, we've been very, I think, quite slowly and patiently looking at the young artists and trying to be very selective, because there have been so many of them. The sort of early focal point of that was a large mixed exhibition we did called Wonderful Life, which was... in a way, an ironic allegory on evolution theory, and applying that, if you know the book by Stephen Gould, applying that in a sense to artists. And so in a sense we were trying to say something to 40 artists, saying there cannot be 40 good artists, but 40 artists can make 40 good works. And as is clear at this point, a number of those artists have come through with a lot of strength, in particular Douglas Gordon, and now Christine Borland, and Jason Martin, and...
Just the final question, Nicholas, and you're very aware of this, we've spoken about it, is the increasing pace with which new artists seem to be arriving, new spaces seem to be opening.
Well, to quote another wonderful collector called Anton Herbert, who I think is probably very known to Giuseppe, he says he doesn't like the artists who are in the hurry business, and I think he's quite right, because what moves too fast in the upward direction generally moves too fast in the downward direction. And I think the really serious artist addresses his work as something that he can't imagine never doing, and that he's going to be doing for the rest of his life, and hopefully, if he's lucky, to maintain some essence of being able to build on core big ideas that emerge in the work in the early days.
And finally, Thomas Wolfen, a critic from Berlin.
I was thinking about the different places I saw connected to Listen Gallery, and I think they did a real good job, and it was always interesting. And I mean, concerning the Venice Biennale, one of the best pavilions on the Venice Biennale is the Rotten Garum, pavilion, the Canadian pavilion. And Rodney Graham is connected to Listen Gallery. So Nicholas always has the luck to be connected to the persons which are right on the spot. I saw Douglas Gordon at the Tate Gallery for the Turner Prize, and that was a great work, the best work. And I mean, he's right on the spot. And I don't know how he managed to do that, but he does it. And so I'm happy to be here on that place for the 30th anniversary. Well,
he's had a very particular perception in British contemporary art over 30 years, and he seems to have had a sensibility to understand the important manifestations that have developed.
Yeah.
And that's interesting, isn't it? Whereas many other galleries haven't.
Yeah, that's one point, and nevertheless, he keeps contact to people who are sort of stepping into the background, but nevertheless are important, like John Latham. So he still shows his work, but he's sort of in a background person. And for example, Art and Language, he's connected to that. And for some people, even one could discuss the development of Art and Language, they nevertheless are of great influence even on contemporary art. And so he's always connected to really contemporary art, and that's great, I think.
Okay, Thomas, I'm just finally, I wonder what you felt was interesting for you in the Biennale this year. Which pavilions, which artists?
I like the, as I already said, I like the Canadian pavilion because of the cyclic movie of Rodney Graham. And then I have to admit I like the Austrian pavilion because in that pavilion there was a step back in a way.
It's Peter Weibel's book.
The Bible's book, but that book was only sort of information concerning a historic development. Me as a German, I know the Viennese group, but showing that in a European context, in an international context, gives them some importance. And you're looking back to the 50s, where in a way everything started. So you will see the old and new work of Michael Escher and the sculpture project in Münster. And that's on the same level. For me, it's a problem that you have to be more contemporary than it's possible. And so I'm looking for people or projects which try to connect the history with the presence. And in that respect, you have that in the Australian Austrian pavilion, and in the project of Michael Escher for this Münster sculpture project. And apart from that, I mean, the rest of the Venice Biennial, the big show, the classical part is sort of awful. The contemporary part is a different form of aperto, but maybe I'm talking in a paradox. That's not too contemporary. We know all these persons which are in the arsenal. So I'm always looking for new names and new figures, but you won't find them in there. So, but I think that's the situation right now. We have to wait maybe the next manifesto, next year or so. There we will have new names. So that's all I could say.